Hi, this is Jack Shalom. There are a few books I've read published in the past decade which I can say changed my political worldview. Those books include Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine and David Graeber's Debt. Now I can add another book to my list, Crowds and Party by Jody Dean. Professor Dean teaches political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Her books include The Communist Horizon, Blog Theory, and Democracy and Other Neoliberal Fantasies. I'm happy to be talking with Jody Dean. Welcome, Jody.
Thanks so much, Jack.
Jody, to begin with, to help situate our listeners, would you give a brief overview of the thesis of your new book, Crowds and Party?
The basic argument is that the left needs to think again about the political form and organize itself as a party.
Because your book is called Crowds and Party, it's organized in such a way that first you talk a lot about crowd theory and what crowds are. And you have a wonderful moment in your introduction where you talk about an incident you heard happen during an Occupy Wall Street demonstration. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, this event was really kind of seminal for me and was what made me write Crowds and Party. So if you recall, if we think back to how exciting Occupy Wall Street was, particularly in New York, it was the most important thing that was going on anywhere, right? Everything, we were all completely energized. It seemed like, wow, you know, the left is waking up. People are coming together. And it was phenomenal. Folks were in giant crowds, in Zuccotti Park, in cities all over the country. But instead of just sitting behind our computers, right, people were outside amassing, talking politically, protesting. It was great. So in one of these Occupy moments was in October, and there had been a giant demonstration in Times Square. And after that, most people went down to Washington Square Park. And so I showed up from the Times Square rally in Washington Square Park with some friends, and there was like a general assembly of about 1,000 people. There were a number of police outside the park on the edges with the barriers ready, and people were discussing whether or not to take the park. And there was an incredible amount of energy. So after people had broken into small groups, they then went back together into the big 1,000-person conversation. So, you know, folks were saying that kind of great rabble-rousing, you know, come on, we can do this, all of this kind of stuff. And in the classic Occupy Wall Street way, the people's mic would repeat it. So it was great. And then this one guy who, in my memory, he looks like Russell Brand. And so he's down in the middle of the group, you know, the kind of, you know, what you expect a kind of radical young guy to look like. And he's, you know, and he's exciting the crowd, like, we can take this park. And the people's mic, everyone yells, we can take this park. And then he says, we can take this park tonight. And everybody yells back, we can take this park tonight. And then he starts to say things like, this is each person's autonomous decision. And someone else, and then the people's mic, people repeat back, this is each person's autonomous decision. I mean, really, at this point, it's like a Monty Python skit. And it's like, you know, no one can decide this for you. And no one can decide this for you. And then a few other things in this vein, and it completely broke the moment. Because where we had been a crowd, like a crowd with energy, a crowd that was utterly courageous, now becomes kind of fragmented into different people worrying about their own stuff. So, of course, the next people who start speaking after fake Russell Brand were saying things like, well, what if we took this park next week? And you know, people yell back, what if we took this park next week? And then, you know, I may not be ready tonight, or NYU has exams tomorrow. And all of the collective energy was lost. So for me, what was crucial there is that the different aspects of Occupy, namely the kind of sort of anarchist part of each person only speaking for themselves and only doing their own thing, plus the collective, I would say, more communist energy of the crowd feeling itself invincible and strong altogether, those two things came up against each other in that moment, and you could see the way that the kind of individualist anarchist moment utterly fragmented and ruptured the energetic communist moment. And so my goal in the book is to find ways to recapture that energetic communist moment and also understand the political party, something like a communist party, as transmitting that moment politically.
Let's talk a little bit more about crowds. You have some wonderful descriptions of the liberatory power of crowds, the way they can disrupt capitalist business as usual. The Paris Commune and Occupy Wall Street are two big examples. But there's also this other strain throughout history of viewing the crowd as a mindless destructive force capable of being easily swayed, as in fact that crowd at Occupy was swayed. Could you talk more about that tension between these two views of the crowd, the liberatory power versus the mindless destructive force?
Yeah. So this is an interesting question, and it's a little tricky. So first, I want to kind of anchor this in early crowd theory, like people like this horrible figure who's super influential, Gustave Le Bon. And he wrote the kind of seminal book on crowds called, effectively, The Crowd. And he captures all of these kind of horrible tendencies of crowds as easily swayed by images, he even calls them a kind of primitive communism. And he is modeling his vision off of Taine's account of the Paris Commune, where the elites see the force of the many out in the streets, and they're really afraid of them. Mm-hmm. Now, they're afraid of the way that the crowds seem to them to be utterly irrational. They're afraid of the way that the crowds have political effects that can't be understood in terms of discussion or instruction, but have something much more sort of earthy or organic. But they're really afraid of something like democracy, like the masses, the many, and they don't like seeing the masses move into politics. In all of the discussions of crowds, in a lot of the crowd literature, the analyst is utterly elitist and awful and really doesn't want to see the many or the people involved in politics. So that's the first thing to think about. Now, it is also a fact that crowds are not typically deliberative bodies. They're different kinds. They're a different kind of political formation. Hmm. What I think of them is, and I get this term from Le Bon, is a heterogeneous unity, a kind of temporary being. And so they need to be understood not as an aggregate just of single people, but in fact as having being a being itself, the force of the many as they cohere for a little bit. For liberals in particular, this can be scary. Because this temporary being gets rid of individuality. There's no sense of each person making their own decision. It's, in fact, the effects of many back on itself. I feel like we've got to own that. We've got to recognize that crowds emerge all the time. They have historically. And own that, keep that power alive, and not reduce our sense of collective effects in politics to just the aggregates of liberal individuals, but give a kind of credence to the disruptive, egalitarian energy of the force of many. And think, okay, this can be channeled in some directions rather than another. The crowd is an opportunity for different kinds of politics. The crowd doesn't really have its own politics, but it pushes the force of the many into a new terrain and opens up the possibility for politics.
Is the virtual crowd different from the physical crowd? It would seem to me that the crowd always carries the actual threat of physical disruption, but the online crowd can only carry implied threats.
Le Bon, weirdly and interestingly, doesn't distinguish. And I think weirdly and interestingly because he's writing at the very beginning of the 20th century. And he thinks about the crowd as just the force of many, whether or not it's in the street or some ways in people's heads. I've been kind of inspired by that to think that maybe a distinction between physical and virtual is not the most useful way of talking about crowds, that the force of many can make itself felt in multiple ways. So that's one pass at that. On the other hand, it does seem to me, like just as a practical thing, that in the streets, the force of many seems much, much greater. Mm-hmm. But then, on the other hand, when we go back to Occupy, for example, it was the blending and shifting and moving back and forth streets and networks that was really important and influential, right? The many in the crowd could see themselves back in the networks and feel even stronger. So I think that maybe we are strongest when we try not to distinguish them, but also recognize that things that just occur on networks are way too ephemeral, that they may not be able and often are not able to affect a gap in our dominant setting in a way that registers.
The crowd is a collection of individuals, but also contains its own unconscious collective imperatives, and you talk a lot about that tension in your book. But you also, when talking about individuals, you make a very strong statement that individuation is fundamentally and deliberately depoliticizing the fantasies of liberals, notwithstanding. So let's talk a little bit about that statement, because I think it's a fascinating statement, and it's a statement where I think there's a lot of political disagreement within the left spectrum.
Yeah, so my basic argument is that the subject of politics can only be collective. The liberal position is that the subject of politics is an individual. So my thought here is that liberalism fragments us. It reduces political behavior to the decisions of individuals. The political problem is then how to get individuals to discuss and decide in some ways rather than other ways. In my view, which I would call a communist view, the political subject can only be collective because the sphere of the political is the struggle between haves and have-nots, between the capitalist and the capitalist class and the working class, the few and the many. And that struggle is always and only the effect of large collectivities against one another. And so that when we try to make it into an individual, we block the social dimensions of that individual. So I'm trying in this book, particularly with the first couple of chapters that are really designed to just take a sledgehammer to the notion of the individual, mm-hmm. and show how that, particularly under contemporary capitalism, the injunction to be an individual, to be unique, to distinguish ourselves, to be so special and great, that this is the worst form of capitalism that is trying to prevent us from feeling the collectivity that we already have and pushing it towards the dismantling of this system and the production of a new one.
Well, I'd like to push back against that a little bit.
Okay.
For example, you say there's nothing necessarily or essentially liberating about the individual form. And then you give the slave trade as an example, and you point out how slaves sold on the basis of their unique individual qualities. But isn't it precisely the subversive individual wish to be free that incited slave rebellions? Ultimately, isn't it the individual wish to be free that begins movements in the first place?
I would say it wasn't an individual wish to be free, right? It's not just like, this one enslaved person thought, oh, this is an unfortunate situation in which I find myself. I'm going to resist it. Slave rebellions were collective. I think that it's crucial, particularly in the U.S., after 30 or 40 years of neoliberalism, it is crucial for us to recover the collective struggles of groups of people throughout our history, rather than reducing them to this individual wanting a better life for himself at a particular time. So I would say that it was the collective push always, rather than just a single one.
Well, that's not to deny that rebellion happens collectively. But what I'm saying is that it's the individual's body that's being assaulted, and that pain is individual pain. Yes, there are others who are suffering that pain, and people see in each other each other's pain. But it does start with the individual.
I don't see why that is a compelling political argument.
Right? Okay.
I don't see why a singular experience transmits into something political. It strikes me as rather that it's the opposite. It's the fact that the experience is widely shared, that the suffering and the pain is widely shared, that it's felt as a harm to one is a harm to many. That, I mean, my kids are home from college, and so we were watching the most recent remake of Roots. And one of the things that was super interesting was the horrifying scene where Kunta Kinte is being beaten by a hideous overseer, is the entire group is expected to watch. The trauma of the beating isn't done hidden in private so that it's felt just by one. Its effect was understood to have to be on the group as a whole. That was part of the horror of it as a mechanism of enslavement so that everyone felt that. So I think it's important that we get away from liberal ideas that want us to turn politics into the affairs of individuals and reduce political action to individual decisions, rather than thinking about collective push, collective anger, collective division, and collective strength.
And you've been listening to Professor Jody Dean, author of the new book, Crowds and Party, published by Verso. Tune in next week at this hour for part two of Professor Dean's fascinating conversation. This is Jack Shalom for Arts Express with host Prairie Miller.